The first thing I thought when I saw these was nobody can ever see these.
An archive of the hopes and dreams of our teenage selves, frozen in time.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden. Last week on All the Best, we played you a selection of stories from our Melbourne Collective's listening party, Keepsakes. We looked at archives, preservation, and the people that keep and collect. This week, we're bringing you the second half, looking at the magic in nostalgia and reflection when we look back at the things we've saved. All the Best's Victorian State Coordinator, Bethany Atkinson-Quinton, and me, Michael Bryden, hosted the event. Our Sin Production Manager, Beck Fari, mixed the audio live on the night. A warning that this first piece contains the names of deceased people that may cause sadness or distress to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. What's a king without a kingdom? What's a queen without respect? What good is nobility without power? In museums all over this country, you can find many and varied king plates. They're these necklace things with a big bit of scrap metal that's ornately cut into the shape of a crescent and engraved with things like Bulgra, King of Aramutta, Billy Kelly, King of Broadwater, King Billy, King Jimmy, Queen Charlotte of Kainumboon, Taboo Jackie, King of Carrara. There are hundreds of them. Most of the stories of these kings and queens are now lost to history, anonymous royals who lived anonymous lives. But we know they were there, not because of crowns or jewels or thrones, but because of bits of old tin and scrap metal they wore around their necks. It's debatable why settlers chose to make these Indigenous kings and queens in communities that had survived without them for thousands of years. Was a king plate given as a sign of respect and understanding between two clashing societies? Or was it used to reward servitude and placate rebelliousness? Or did we just do it because it could be done? The truth is, it's probably all of the above. But on both sides of the rift, these king plates were protected and saved and preserved. Those bits of scrap metal and the titles they came with were worn with pride by Indigenous elders, and now those bits of scrap metal are stored in museums with pride by white Australians. We could look back and say that white men who lovingly cut, polished and engraved these plates were really giving these Indigenous men and women power, nobility and trying to carve them a place in a new society. But honestly, we all know that those kings and queens would have been treated with about the same value and respect as their scrap metal jewellery. It's for this reason that when people like you and me find ourselves in rooms like this on nights like tonight, that we ask ourselves, what's a king without a kingdom? What's a queen without respect? And what good is nobility without power? And we remember the old kings and queens of Australia.
The first half of the night was all about capturing, documenting, collecting, the active process of archiving. Now we get to the magic, the nostalgia, the reflection where meaning is dredged up and enhanced, distorted and reimagined. In this next story, Sascha Rosen takes us back to East Germany to meet a man who was involved with one of the most infamous archives of the Cold War, a detailed and intimate record created without consent through espionage and the invasion of privacy. Sascha Rosen.
I don't know if you know much about East Germany during the Cold War. They had this state spy agency, the Stasi.
The Staatssicherheit, they call us a state security system.
They kept files on huge numbers of their citizens. I'm simplifying, but almost everyone was being spied on. They even had a library of smells.
They had also a library of smells, yes.
Why would they have that?
I think this is one of the methods these totalitarian systems used to identify suspicious people, to find out where they have been, what they have done. They used also dogs to smell and to identify. They even kept also the smell samples in little glasses.
Lars Rutz lives in Sydney now, but he grew up in East Germany. Germany got cut in two after World War II. The West was democratic and friends with the United States. the East was communist and friendly with the Soviet Union. Lars tried to escape from the communist East into the democratic West. There was literally a wall between the two halves. The city of Berlin had the Berlin Wall. And Lars tried to get across it. Eventually, he succeeded. He'd lived in West Berlin right after he escaped. And after the wall fell, it actually opened up, it was demolished later on. Once the wall opened in 1989, the Cold War ended. East and West joined together, just kind of became Germany, and Lars ended up moving to Sydney and getting a job here in Australia as an archivist, actually. An archivist needs to work out how to make things survive long enough to be looked for again and to be found once, you know, you are looking for them. The things we archive are things that we know will help define us sometime in the future. And it takes a special kind of anticipation, of planning and of knowing. Knowing things about paper stock, temperature, filing systems, moisture. To get it right. Even the Stasi, those East German secret police, had to know these things. After the Cold War, the Stasi files were saved from destruction, and that archive was opened up in 1992. The Stasi had been secretive. This new Germany would be open. You generally couldn't look at anyone else's file, but you could look at your own. And a lot of the time, that was a really, really thorough description of your life, which meant that you got to find out which one of your friends was spying on you. And of course, Lars got to look at his own file. So what did you expect to find in these files?
I expected betrayal. But I also expected that someone is keeping a diary about my life in East and even in the West.
What did you actually find?
I found letters, which I've written and which were also addressed to me from friends, from family. But I also found photos of me when I was in East, near the wall in East Berlin. I found photos of me demonstrating in front of Checkpoint Charlie.
And he actually kind of appreciated the quality of their filing system?
I must say I've found it surprising how thorough the system was developed and how sophisticated the archival system was developed by the Stasi. Because they kept files of millions of their own citizens. They employed archivists who kept this file on their citizens. I found it highly sophisticated and quite admire the way how they kept the system, putting aside the nature of archive. It is very complicated, mixed feeling. On the other hand, also, I'm quite grateful that I can now read also my own file, because I would have liked to keep diary about the time. The photos, I couldn't believe how I looked. And I'm also happy that many of the letters between my family and my friends when I was living in the East and West were copied. And so I kept them and I treasured them also.
You'd think with so much information that the Stasi would know all the things going on in his life. But even though you can archive the details of someone's life, that doesn't mean you necessarily understand them. There was this time when Lars went to the Brandenburg Gate, the border. At the Berlin Wall, around this time, there were a bunch of gates where you could get through from one side to the other, if you were lucky, the Brandenburg Gate, Checkpoint Charlie. And while he worked in the West, Lars did keep protesting against the East German regime.
When I was living in West Berlin, I also started to demonstrate. I started to go on a regular basis to Checkpoint Charlie and demonstrate against the East German system.
Checkpoint Charlie was the border between the two halves of the city.
Yes. And each year, which is the anniversary when the wall was built, the 13th of August, we gathered with many others together and demonstrated.
And while they were in the West, the East kept spying on them, even from the other side of the wall in a new country.
Even when I was in West, I knew I was monitored and my telephone connection in West Germany, in West Berlin, was also tapped.
And then there was this one day. Lars was safe. He was in West Berlin, safe enough from the Stasi. He went to a different gate in the wall, to the Brandenburg Gate. And if you look at his Stasi file for that day, there's a photo of Lars on a platform. They had these viewing platforms where you could just look across the gate. That was the thing they did. And he was at the gate, and there's a photo, because something happened while he was there.
There was a case where there was an attack done near the Brandenburger Gate, someone threw a Molotov cocktail to the wall, and I was accused as a terrorist. I had nothing to do with it.
You just happened to be standing on a viewing platform.
I was there. I was at the platform at the time, but I didn't have anything to do with this particular attack. But there was a complete file about this incident.
The Stasi had put two and two together and decided Lars was involved. It just happened that they were completely wrong. It was bad maths, which makes you wonder.
They create a story, but the story is told from the perspective of someone who doesn't know you, who is also your ideological enemy, the person who is doing his job, and he's going into a very fine detail about your life. Without your permission, he's even going further, also to report and to share this story about your very intimate life with others. And I didn't like this.
Even the Stasi like to make up stories. They tried to join the dots. I mean, people like to make up stories from little points of data, marking out, you know, little constellations between stars. But the stars don't draw these constellations. Those lines are ours. We like to find the signal in the noise. So sometimes we just make it up. But stars don't talk back, and people do. I mean, I like to think I know better than all those spies. I asked Lars permission to tell the story, his story. He came into the studio, he told me these things, you know, on purpose. But, I mean, this is 10 minutes out of an hour of recording, and these are tiny moments from Lars' life added up to a story that's still my edited version of his real life. And, you know, real life isn't a story, even if our experience of it feels like one. Inside us, stories curl and unspring themselves and arrive without really being asked for. We connect the man on the platform to a gate to a Molotov cocktail. We link these three things together in a narrative in a way that they never quite connected, not in real life. But it's hard to know if we've joined these dots all that well, I mean, even now, because what is history like this other than a collection of isolated moments bunched together, linked by human perception, flawed reading, and stories unwinding inside us, which goes for spies, or for you, or for me.
Zacher Rosen.
The archives of the Stasi can only be followed by archives of the most top secret, confidential, and potentially shaming documents, the diaries of a teenage girl. Next up, Beth Gibson delves back into her diary to uncover the dark world behind growing up. Beth Gibson.
Sometimes I watch children playing together and think, I wish I could be a kid again. They're running around, giggling, falling over, giggling, laughing some more, still having such a good time. In those moments, it's hard to imagine bad thoughts in their little heads. Recently, I found a couple of my old diaries. One was pink, one was covered in stickers.
Dear diary, I decided I'm going to start a diary since I am reading Anne Frank's diary. Time is 8:15 a.m. and I am bored. Dear diary, today was a reasonably stable, unexciting day. I talked to Zoe on MSN and told her how annoying everyone is.
I kept reading and reading and started to feel uneasy.
Dear diary, I'm home, it's 10:54 and I had a crappy time at Sarah's. Everyone was boring me to death. Sophia is really annoying. Jess is so annoying. Everything she says feels so pointless and uninteresting. She's so self-absorbed. Sarah was smiling. That's all I can say for her. If she does not win, there is a crisis. Georgia, yuck. No comment there. She hates everyone. She is such a bitch. Boring as hell. I hate Rachel. Nothing we did is even worth mentioning. She pisses me off. It's funny, but I don't really like any of my friends.
What? How was the child version of myself so angry? This was not how I remembered myself. I thought I was this like dreamy, naive kid with imaginary friends who was too nice for her own good. No. The first thing I thought when I saw these was nobody can ever see these. But I just couldn't help wondering, like, who was I really as a 10-year-old? These diaries had totally shattered any truth I thought I knew about myself as a kid, and I needed to know, like, what did they mean and what could I learn from them? So I decided to call up some people who knew me well as a 10-year-old.
Now, remember that I really only got my hands on you properly until you were about 4.
This is Helen. It's hard to explain my relationship with Helen, so I'll just say that she's like a godmother. Helen's memories fit well with this idea that I had of myself as a kid.
You were very thoughtful, and if you focused on something, you really focused.
I think that you were an observing child. I remember you as someone who, with your very big brown eyes, would watch a lot.
That's Mum, and her memories fit this idea too.
You were a creative child, very imaginative child. Your tendency to come down in these elaborate costumes and with just pillowcases on your head, or with anything you found, you would dress up in a most elaborate way with long jewellery and shoes. And
so what happened to this lovely, dreamy child? How did I go from pillowcases as headdresses to...
Sophia is really annoying me. Dad took me to the newsagents and I got Dolly. Now, I've been getting Dolly for some time now, and the best thing about it is that Sophia is not allowed to get it. So in a way, it's like the one thing I've got and she doesn't. But now she's convinced her mum to get it for her, and now it's all she talks about. Ugh!
You're a little bit, I think, possibly a little bit shy when you started school. You started school at 4, nearly 5, and we could have held you back a year, but we thought, you know, academically you were ready. There was an idea that you were kind of being bullied or excluded. What do you remember of that?
I don't quite remember what exactly happened.
I'm lying there. I totally remember that time, and so does my best friend from primary school, Laura.
Honestly, like, before we enter this, you were a petal. Like, you were like, people are so mean to me, and I was just like, no, this is what it's like having siblings.
Laura is clearly a little harsher on me than my mum, but it's talking to her that I'm really reminded of how hard primary school could be at times.
Do you remember them bullying me?
They bullied everyone. Yeah. Even if you were part of the group, you were bullied. Like, it's actually a mean girls phenomenon.
She's right. Most kids got bullied at some point. Social structures were constantly rearranging, with different kids ending up on the bottom each time.
Becky's as mean as a post. I hate the way they make orders to Laura. Crunchies, picnics, Mars bars, everything for nothing.
God, this is horrible reliving memories. I was pretty much sat at a table next to either Becky or Michaela.
And the deal was that you had to get them chocolate bars to be able to sit with them.
Yeah, like, how the fuck did that happen? Seriously, primary school was probably the worst time of my life. Like, people that are like, oh, your childhood? I'm like, you fucking kidding me.
Why do you think it was the worst time of your life?
I think it's because you get the least direction. You've got more conflicting ideas coming at you with less ability to actually handle them.
It makes sense that primary school was tough. You've got hundreds of kids all from totally different families with totally different ideas about how the world works, and they're all in the same playground, figuring out for maybe the first time how to get along. No wonder I was a little bit angry. But even so, I thought I was the kind of kid who was above petty, mean insults. And that's what these entries were. They were mean. And maybe that's the ugly truth that these diaries reveal, that I'm very much capable of being mean, that I'm a mean person even, and that idea is terrifying to me.
Dear diary, Sophia is really annoying. She was so She hates everyone. Yuck. No, she's boring such as a bitch. Hell. Rachel. Nothing she pisses me off. Funny, but I don't really like any of my friends.
And then I came upon this one entry that was kind of different to the others.
Dear diary, I really hate something about me. I let everyone boss me around. They just waltz right up and take my food. They steal my hats and I don't give up a fight. They tell me to do something and I do it. I hate it. So from now on, I'm going to change. Starting Monday, I'll be more assertive. Tell people that it's mine, that I don't want to do it.
I think this entry gives me insight into why I kept a diary in the first place. It was like a way of building an identity that was constantly shifting and constantly under threat. Maybe those entries, I hate Sophia, I hate Sarah, et cetera, were less about Sophia and Sarah and more about me trying to figure out who I was, writing myself away from certain people and towards others. Maybe by writing out those feelings, honestly, I was just trying to process them, using them to construct my own narrative.
Okay, so this diary entry starts out very positively. It's June 22nd, 2001, and I'm like, yes, it's the holidays. I've been way too busy with summer and all, but it's summer, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. Oh, and I forgot to tell you the top 10 reasons why I hate Amanda. Number one, she's mean. Number two, she always gets her way. Number three, she shows off. Number four, she thinks it's totally cool to have a name that rhymes with panda. Number five, she also thinks she's related to pandas. In brackets, how dumb. Number six, she thinks that copying is bad. Number seven, she copied me and she said she hadn't. Number eight, she's popular for being dumb. Number nine, she's now friends with Shelby. Number 10, she's mean.
Right. I think that's fairly normal, I would imagine, at that sort of age. That's pretty normal, but yeah, you wrote it all down.
Did Amanda become unpopular when you
met? I don't know.
I see it as a fairly natural consequence of the way you approached life, which was thinking about things and analysing them and putting it down.
I think it's easy to romanticise children, easy to watch them playing and laughing and think, don't they have it easy? But being a kid isn't easy. It's fucking hard. Like everyone else, they're in the messy business of figuring out who they are. I did some of that figuring out in my diaries and ultimately I'm glad that I did. I've got this window into who I used to be and kid Beth, she's not that different from adult Beth. Although, hopefully, I'm a little bit less petty now. Either way, I'm still figuring it out, one diary entry at a time.
Beth Gibson. Where Beth Gibson's childhood writing drove a wedge between her and her romantic view of childhood. Next up, we've got a story about childhood friends revisiting writings that were made to try and keep them together. In this next story, Cassandra Wright and Melissa Fletcher Young are going to take us deep into the brain box. It's a box of keepsakes they made with their friends a long time ago, and I'm sure that when they created it, they never expected to open it up this wide.
It seems almost unbelievable, but Melissa and I have been friends for around 10 years now.
Oh, that's gross.
If it explains anything, we met in an all-girls high school.
Where we were a part of a group of super creative and artistic young girls who sort of bypassed hooking up with boys, going to parties and getting drunk for things like drama games, SingStar sleepovers and picnics in the park.
In other words, we were kind of losers, but we loved each other for it.
Our friendship was so important to the six of us. Myself, Cassie, Nikki, Jess, Shannon and Olivia.
I always thought of us kind of as like the people who didn't fit in, the cool outsiders.
You guys were the first friends that I'd had for such a long time.
Our group was like a safe haven.
It was kind of like this was the place where people came when like their friends kicked them out of a group.
So we had people join and people go away, but us six were always there.
Being part of that six became quite exclusive, even when we did have other friends hanging around us. which I did feel uneasy about sometimes.
I mean, we had the bigger group at school, but it was nice to have that smaller group where we could do things a bit different and not have to think about everyone else.
So I think we felt kind of like loyal to each other, and we wanted to celebrate our like special bond with like a special celebration that no one knew about apart from us.
Looking back, it was a little strange, but it was nice, you know. It was sort of our thing.
Being the huge nerds that we were, clearly, we created a top secret club for the six of us, steeped in tradition and ritual and all sorts of things that we thought would ensure that we stayed best friends forever. One of these rituals involved an annual Christmas party where we would place a letter to our future selves to be opened in a year's time.
An archive of the hopes and dreams of our teenage selves, frozen in time. A safe protected by ritual and trust, containing secret letters and mementos from our former selves. The Brain Box.
The Brain Box was Olivia's art project.
I was obsessed with you guys, like completely obsessed. I took images, I think, off MySpace.
She stenciled that on in paint.
And I stuck them on this box and it ended up looking kind of half done.
I don't think she liked it very much.
But I was like, well, I've got to keep it. It's got like these images of my friends on it.
I remember like, oh, we've got this box. We all need to write letters and make a time capsule.
To write a letter to the rest of us to be opened in a year's time.
It was kind of like a weird, desperate way to like keep us together.
And I remember distinctly one particular person saying that we were too immature to know what she'd written.
Yeah, Jess.
Yeah, Olivia and I walked home with Jess every day and we talked about the letters and she's like, oh, it's just something that you guys aren't mature enough to understand right now. So like I've written it to tell you in a year.
So none of us were really engaging much in relationships for various reasons. Awkwardness for some of us, closeted gayness for others. Jess, she'd acquired a boyfriend, I think, like the start of year 12 or something.
Yeah, they met at Justice and Democracy Camp.
Yeah, she was always kind of the one we considered the shy, innocent one of sorts.
You were, yes, like a bit like squealy about like sex-related, yeah, stuff up until that point. So I guess, yeah, if you had have told us
I
at the time.
I would say prudish, perhaps.
well, let's go with squealy. It's cuter.
That was what was in the letter.
Yeah, like, so we opened the letter and Jess's one was, I have to let you all know, I am not a virgin anymore.
That was one of the reasons why I didn't tell you guys when I had sex the first time, because I was meant to be the virginal religious girl.
No. It wasn't a big deal that it was that. It was a big deal because it was a year of anticipation, because it was like, oh, I've written something in there, but you're not mature enough to know what it is right now.
So I was so offended. I was like, I have huge secrets about like gayness and you don't think that I can handle you having sex.
I feel like if there hadn't been such a big lead up, like you wrote it in a box and didn't read it for a year, like, you could have just said, hey guys, I had sex last night.
But it was a big deal.
Oh yeah, totally.
Well, I'm glad that it wasn't just me thinking it was a big deal.
The Brain Box was meant to pass from house to house until it was open again in a year's time. But the last time we did this was at the end of year 12.
Instead, life happened. Friendships crumbled, hearts were broken, and the Brain Box sat in Melissa's room, locked and collecting dust for over 6 years.
We wondered what it would be like to reopen the box and take a look back at our younger selves. What were in those unopened letters, and what did the other girls remember from that time in our lives? I was kind of worried from the start about whether this reunion would even be possible. I mean, the six of us hadn't been in the same room together now for years. Would they even be open to seeing each other again, let alone delving back into the often cringy moments of our teenage years?
For me, opening the box and coming face to face with our teenage selves felt like closure, and as the day grew closer, I didn't know if I was ready for that. The traditions and rituals that we'd formed in order to stay friends forever, they hadn't worked, but some part of me still believed that as long as we had the box and the letters, we'd still have a reason to come back to each other. I really wasn't ready to let that go.
We're looking at a box that Olivia made for an art project and she didn't like it.
That's true.
And it's got portraits of us on the front of it, which I always thought were cute.
It's the Brain Box, guys. It has a name and it's also much smaller than I remember.
How big did you think it was?
Well, bigger, like bigger than a milk crate. But it's actually roughly the size of a milk crate. I don't know, maybe it was just bigger in my brain with the significance it holds in my heart.
How do you feel? Because I don't feel good about this.
I like that Jess, it feels really lovingly about the box, and I feel like you're the only one that does.
But it's a treasure box. Like, it's literally a freaking treasure box. It has bejeweled locks on it. And it's got our faces on it, and our faces from high school that Ollie painted. Like, that's precious, guys.
Why do none of you feel this magical about the box?
I really want to take the locks off. I just want to open it.
Yeah, let's do it. Here we go.
Someone else take another one off.
I want this big one.
The tricky one. I guess I'm the only other person within reach.
Yeah, do it.
Okay, ready?
There we go. Okay.
I feel like it should make a creaking noise.
No creaking.
To be honest, I'm really glad that there isn't a nest of spiders in there.
So, how many letters do we write in this? I don't remember.
Okay, so there's going to be two lots of letters in here, I think.
Okay. It's just glitter.
Wait, what's this?
There's a videotape in there.
There's a videotape.
Oh, there's Melissa. Classified tape. Don't tape over.
What's on that?
Mine says Cassandra Jade Wright to be opened in 2011.
All right.
Or at the end of 2010. And it says, let's go to Penn Island.
Oh my god, I shoved mine full of glitter.
Okay, I'm going to read my first paragraph. Dear future Cassie and future Shannon and future Melissa and future Nikki and future Jess and future Olivia, I bet you're all naked right now. Wink.
Greetings, fair maidens. Jess just said that we've
been a year, or maybe less, if we actually get our act together and have our meeting before Christmas.
Dear future self, hi, I have the urge to put a smiley face here because I've been on Facebook far too much.
But dear friends, love you more than rainbow fairy cakes.
So dated the 11th of February 2010 to the me of 10 months time. Lol.
Sorry this letter has been written late, but I'm sure you'll all remember the Facebook email problem.
Something. Cassie said that we are unshallow, but that doesn't quite cover it. The fact is, our group is so accepting I can't
apart
even
apart from starting uni this year, I guess I really want to find a guy who will love me for me.
And it ended well with my first boyfriend, Dario, aka Fighting Chicken or El Diablo.
I'm glad I'm not as fat as I was in the pre-year 10 theft video. Cassie, if you are that fat, get some help, okay?
This year did some stuff to me both mentally and physically that really makes me want to punch someone in anger.
Stay in touch with reality.
Stay bestest friends with you all and bestest of bestest friends with Nikki.
Sleepy homerooms and bus rides with Shannon. Bagging Mr. Greg's lame jokes with Nikki.
The second guy was that dickhead Dave in capitals, who I met at our Year 12 formal.
Year 12 was hard, however. I made it through and got
an opportunity. I'm not entirely sure about Swinburne as a uni, but I'm going to give it a go and make the most of it.
I started going out with Lisa, but I know that's really weird, so I didn't want to be too open about it.
Because this guy was so superficial and just like me because I look cute in dim form.
Some people might tease us at times, but there are other, more important people in the world who will like us for who we are. If all of us can love each other this much, other people can too.
But I still very much want to get out of Dingley and travel around Europe.
And have I gotten need to make over me some money 7 hours on my L's yet? If not,
none of you should be pregnant by now, I hope.
All of you had a great 2010. I love you all from past Shannon.
And at the moment I'm happy and I hope this feeling lasts.
As I ended my first letter, peace out. Nikki and Williams. End of 2009, start of 2010.
It's kind of interesting how this box that we thought was a physical symbol of the failure of our friendship ended up being the very thing that brought the six of us together once more.
We hadn't all spoken in years, and that night we talked for hours. Our confusion, our insecurity, our flaws were all brought so sharply into focus by people who would never become strangers, as they would always hold a part of us. Coming face to face with my shame, my body, my teenage dreams, it was excruciatingly awkward. But as we realised, there's no set of people I'd rather be awkward with. Thank you.
Thank you.
All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and RRR in Melbourne. Thanks to all the producers that contributed to Keepsakes, and a special thanks to the Good Room in Brunswick for putting on the event and the exhibition. The stories we recorded at Keepsakes have been transformed into an audio exhibition, and if you're in Melbourne, we'd love for you to pay Keepsakes a visit. Hit up the All the Best Facebook page for details on the Good Room and the Keepsakes exhibition. It's running for just one more week until November 19th. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beck Fiery is our SYN Production Manager. Jess Hamilton is my co-host. And I'm Michael Bryden. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can also find our archive at allthebestradio.com. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.